CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Environmental law, as we define in the future, will either organize society's final assaults on nature, or it will catalyze a planetary defense of nature. It will either fuel a final tyranny, or it will breathe new life into democracy. Nature's laws govern everyone. It will take all of us in this living generation to rise to this moment.
That's Mary Wood, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Mary Wood on environmental law and the defense of nature. As ecosystems collapse and the climate emergency intensifies, the government often uses its authority to allow the very harm that it is supposed to prevent. Sound crazy? It is. The granting of permits is a battleground where corporations, with their oodles of money to buy influence, have the upper hand over nature. In the face of corporate greed and the enormity of the climate crisis, we need action now before it is too late. An ancient and enduring principle is the trust doctrine. It asserts public property rights to crucial resources such as forests, rivers, minerals, and fisheries. Its core logic compels government as trustee to protect nature and to safeguard the resources we rely on for survival. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says, "We must end the merciless, relentless, senseless war on nature." Amen to that. Our guest today is Mary Wood. She's professor of law and faculty director of the University of Oregon School of Law's Environmental and Natural Resources Law Program. She gave the keynote address of the annual Public Interest Environmental Law Conference at the University of Oregon in Eugene in early March. And now, Mary Wood.
As Oren Lyon explains it, the thing you have to understand about nature and natural laws, there's no mercy. There's only law. Environmental law's main purpose is to keep us in compliance with these laws of nature, because there is no negotiating our way out of those. If environmental law becomes unmoored from nature's laws, society will eventually collapse. And environmental law, no matter how voluminous, will have been irrelevant. And that seems to be about where we stand right now. For the past 50 years, half century, we've defined this field by a set of statutes passed in the 1970s, including the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, NEPA, the Endangered Species Act, the Public Lands Statutes, and many others. And states and local governments passed their own laws in the same model, and so do many other countries. So let's examine those for a bit. All of these legislatively enacted laws rely on agencies to carry out their mandates, agencies that exist within the executive branch. You can think of nature in its entirety as partitioned among all of these executive bureaucracies, spanning the federal, state, and local levels. And under these statutes, the agencies exert nearly full dominion over nature. This hulking administrative state came to pass not so much by design or forethought, but really more by happenstance. And in retrospect, it was one big experiment, and it grew enormous power that defied standard democratic constraints. Now, if you were to picture this field of law, you might imagine each statute as a very deep cavern that leads down into subterranean tunnels. There are thousands of those statutory caverns across the field of environmental law. And governmental officials and environmental advocates step into them, and many never emerge because the sheer regulatory complexity, as my law students know, draws them deeper and deeper into a maze that veers further and further away from fundamental principles and from ecological reality. Let's not pretend that this environmental law has been protective. It clearly hasn't been. Agencies turned against the people decades ago, and communities all across the country are fighting their own government under these laws. Consider what these statutes have brought. Toxic pollution, nuclear waste, clear-cutting, mountaintop removal, strip mining, wetlands destruction, fracking, deep-sea drilling, species extinction, dried-up rivers, ocean acidification, ocean dead zones, climate crisis, and almost indescribable mutilation of landscapes across this nation. We have now contamination of every food group, and the blood of 97% of us has the forever chemical PFAS, which the EPA should have banned decades ago. Now, granted, there were a few early successes. The rivers stopped catching fire anymore. Lead was taken out of gasoline, smog diminished, but despite some gains, during the last half century, industries have deployed black belt capability towards every living system that is crucial to our survival. We can't even package our losses anymore in discrete metrics like water pollution levels or numbers of listed species or acres of wetlands gone. These are completely eclipsed by the metastasizing environmental syndromes that tear at the web of life itself. Even the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has pronounced that we're nearing the eve of destruction, direct quote. We are on track for a planetary heating by the end of this century that is not broadly survivable. If you are not waking up in the middle of the night over this, you probably haven't put all these pieces together. Our environmental statutes affirmatively legalize all of this destruction. What explains this? Well, nearly every statute has this structure. It first declares a legislative purpose of protecting the environment. So far, so good. But then it delegates authority to an agency to issue permits or leases that allow the very damage that the statute was designed to prevent. Now, these permit provisions were never intended to swallow the statute's purposes, but that is, in fact, what happened. The overarching agency mindset is that permits are there to be granted. Every drilling project, every open pit mine, every clear cut of ancient forest goes forward under leases or permits issued by agencies under environmental law. Agencies across the country perpetrate precisely what these laws were designed to prevent. How did agency discretion come to work so viciously against the public when so many people protect their rivers, fisheries, lands, and climate system? Well, this one word, discretion, kind of holds it all. The statutes give agencies in the executive branch enormous discretion, and that discretion acts as a magnet for political influence by the industries and developers, let's not forget them, who seek permits or leases under these laws. Industry puts relentless pressure on agencies to relax regulation, and much of the agency decision-making is hidden from the public. And so this alone causes some real systemic dysfunction. And industry captains send large campaign contributions to the president and governors, who then appoint agency heads, and they send campaign contributions to the legislators who fund agency budgets and to the county commissioners and port authorities. They target virtually everyone with environmental authority. These campaign contributions literally purchase influence, and everyone knows this. After years of this pressure, an agency falls captive to the very industry it regulates. And at that point, government officials look at the industry as a client they must serve. Professor Oliver Houck once wrote in the context of the Forest Service that discretion fools no one. It means the timber industry gets to cut more timber. And with moneyed politics driving decisions, the worst damage often hits those with the least political power, which explains why toxic waste facilities are overwhelmingly sited near low-income communities and communities of color. So often, discretion leads right into environmental racism. Well, these dynamics subsumed environmental law. They induced land use officials to allow suburban sprawl, and they moved state water agencies to appropriate rivers until many ran dry, and they drove biological opinions to keep our iconic salmon near extinction, and they kept Oregon's Department of Forestry looking the other way as private timber companies ravaged our ancient forests. Environmental law delivered the climate emergency to your doorstep. Statutory law legalized all facets of the fossil fuel system, from the coal fire plants to the offshore drilling to the gas guzzling cars, all of it. As James Speth shows in his book, they knew. Administrations going back to Lyndon B. Johnson were repeatedly warned that climate disruption would start spinning out of control around just this time, our time. These disasters you read about every day in the papers, they've come all right on schedule. You may ask, how could our leaders have knowingly put us in this peril? And it is because the fossil fuel industry holds an iron grip on American politics and has used it to steer American energy policy to serve its own ends. Nature can't take unending harm. At some point, it all adds up. You know, long ago, I wondered, with all the mounting damage I was seeing, I thought, could there ever be a time when humanity itself would be threatened? Would the job of environmental lawyers turn into something that had such grave implications that one day we would be holding the future on our shoulders in a way prior generations had not? And at that time, I remember I just couldn't quite banish that haunting possibility. And now, isn't that exactly where we stand today? And yet, the laws have not changed. So, if you ask me to describe our system of environmental law, I would say it's the cane upon which humanity leans as we walk the plank towards our own destruction. We no longer have the ability to fix environmental law through incremental reform. We don't have the time. Citizen groups are running around doing their best to challenge government case by case, but they are losing the battle by not getting at the systemic forces that drive our agencies to make devastating decisions. As Ross Galbsman said, these groups are running around trying to put out all these fires, but nobody's going after the pyromaniac here. Well, we lawyers tend to burrow down into specific doctrines and court rulings and regulations, and we miss the social frame through which these outcomes emerge. A social frame is something well beyond a legal doctrine. Social frames are powerful because they influence people's account of reality. Frames can oppress and subdue, or they can empower and mobilize. Frames can legitimize massive ruin, or they can demand survival, protection, and recovery. The frame controlling the past 5 decades of environmental statutory law is a frame of political discretion. This frame normalizes decisions based on raw political calculation. When a statute fails to protect a community, we chalk it up to politics, don't we? This frame would benefit a monarchy or oligarchy. You can reform any law you want, in any way you want, but if it's carried out through this frame, it will justify the destruction of nature. And this is because our money-controlled politics justifies that end. When we think about the transition ahead, we urgently need a frame that transforms political discretion into sovereign obligation to the people. And we must give content to that obligation and make it enforceable within the system of checks and balances that our Constitution demands. A frame change offers a new account of what is legitimate and what is not. As George Lakoff says, reframing is changing what counts as common sense. And we had better make certain that we get our framing right. And then we do so before ChatGPT starts doing it for us. Or worse, does it for those who seek to bend discretion for their own private gain. We have an operable principle in our law that presents the very antithesis of political discretion. It's called the public trust. It came twin-born with our democracy, has been recognized by our courts since the earliest days of our nation, and remains embedded in our constitutional understandings. You might well wonder why environmental advocates have not often asserted it. It's a good question. It's because over the last half century, they have been consumed with the morass of statutory law. The public trust declares a public property right in crucial natural resources and characterizes our government as trustee of those resources. You can imagine an ecological endowment with all the resources essential to our welfare and survival, including the waters, the wildlife, the air, the stream beds. Our ancestors drew their life from this trust, as we do, and so must our descendants. We share this trust with all of those species that fill us with wonder and awe, and we share it no less with the microbes and the worms and the bees and the plankton, the full web of life. The public trust principle requires government to sustain this ecology for us and for future generations and for all of species as the people's lasting commonwealth. The trust has roots dating back to Roman law, and it exists in many other democracies around the world as well. So it has truly global reach. You can understand why. Any government that fails to protect its natural resources condemns its people to misery and keeps them subservient. This principle makes clear that our government doesn't have the power that a monarchy or dictator would. It operates as the people's restraint on government power. As Professor Sachs said, the public trust distinguishes a society of citizens from a society of serfs. And so you won't find this principle alive in Russia or other autocracies. But the logic of democracies is this: all power accruing to government, every bit of it, derives from we the people. And we the people never gave our government the power to destroy what remains essential for our survival and prosperity. So as beneficiaries of the trust, the people hold back and reserve property rights, public property rights in crucial ecology, as an enduring trust. The landmark decision in this country was Illinois Central Railroad, decided back in 1892. And in that case, the Illinois legislature had conveyed the entire Chicago shoreline of Lake Michigan to a private railroad company. Can you imagine? This was shoreline that the citizens were using for fishing and navigation commerce. And the U.S. Supreme Court held the grant invalid because it found a shoreline had to be held in trust for the public. It said that a grant of valuable shoreline to a railroad would be a grievance which could never be long borne by a free people. And many courts since have said that the public trust is an attribute of sovereignty, part of government's very architecture, that can't be destroyed except by destruction of the sovereign itself. So it's a species of constitutional law. The first and most basic fiduciary obligation requires government to protect our trust and not allow substantial impairment of the resources. You know, you wouldn't put your money in a bank only for that bank to intentionally deplete it, would you? Under a trust frame, protection, not destruction, must become the default mode of regulation. And this is an active duty. Trustees can't just sit idle and permit trust assets to be destroyed on their watch. But our agencies ran that substantial impairment stop sign long ago. Massive clear cuts have wrecked entire watersheds in Oregon, decimating fish-bearing streams and wildlife habitat, and all with the permission of forestry officials acting under statutes but in breach of their public fiduciary duty. Well, where the trustee allows damage, it must restore the trust. Of course, in private trust law, don't just allow the trustee to walk away after pillaging a trust. Government owes us restoration all over the place. second duty requires the trustees to achieve the highest and best use of public resources. This only makes sense. These are our public resources. Government should manage them for the highest public benefit, but statutes rarely ask the question of public purpose. Consider the matter of pollution. Our environmental agencies hand out free permits that allow industry to use our air and our waters as their dumping grounds. Can pollution ever be the highest and best use of these resources? Most industries have never had to revamp, even though many could, because agencies just keep reissuing their permits to pollute. This fiduciary duty calls the entire permitting system into question. And back to forests. How can clear-cut be the highest and best use of mature or old-growth forests in Oregon? It just can't be. Our west side forests are some of the most carbon-dense storehouses in the world. We have the Amazon forest of North America right in our backyard. So why would we destroy it or cut it on short rotation when we now face the prospect of runaway planetary heating? Society's needs have changed abruptly. In this new world, we need forests to sequester carbon and supply drinking water and biodiversity. A third duty requires trustees to administer the trust for the people overall rather than for the primary purpose of benefiting a private party. Well, this makes sense. We are the beneficiaries. Yet how often has this been violated? How many times have we heard port officials promote fossil fuel export facilities that would destroy fisheries and waterways and lead to massive carbon emissions in order to create a few dozen longshoremen jobs? How many times have federal agencies approved plans for cyanide heap leach gold mines on pristine public lands to benefit a foreign mining company? The Forest Service is poised to do just that in Idaho for two mines, putting a pig in the parlor right next to spectacular wilderness. The political discretion frame of statutory law blithely condones these decisions made for private parties over the broader public interest. And a final fiduciary duty is the duty of loyalty to the citizens and the correlative duty to avoid conflicts of interest. Courts understand that trustees have immense control over property. So in a private trust, courts will avoid decisions tainted by bias. If we applied this standard to our public trustees, we would frontally challenge the practice of accepting campaign contributions from industries that stand to benefit from environmental decisions. Everyone knows these campaign contributions cause self-interested decision-making by the people we elect to office. The problem is not that this corruption goes unrecognized, but that it has become institutionalized. Citizens just don't know of any other paradigm that would yield a higher standard of ethical behavior from their government. So enforcing a duty of loyalty could be a game changer for ecological management. Well, you can see how this trust repositions all players in their relationship to ecology. It conceives of government officials as public trustees rather than as disloyal bureaucrats. The citizens are beneficiaries with a clear public property interest in natural resources rather than as weakened political constituents with increasingly desperate appeals to beg of their public officials. And nature is an endowment holding priceless value for future generations rather than a vague environment with intangible value. You can take any environmental issue, and when you see it through this trust lens, it will shape your expectations of what you require from your government. And why is this important? Because our expectations of government form the lifeblood of democracy. The public trust is not just some claim that lawyers can assert in court cases. By far, its larger potential is changing political culture, which is always the product of the people's expectations. And as we enter a time of mind-blowing climate urgency and food and water scarcity, we need very clear expectations of how our government will manage and allocate our survival resources. There are many good people in agencies, so spark change from within wherever we can. So, operating with a public trust expectation, how do we turn course into uncharted territory. Well, I would like to offer five beacons, I'll call them, that can guide us. And I hope this is only a start in our collective thinking, because for us to just stay down in those deep statutory caverns seems to me to be an annihilative strategy for nature and people alike. And so the beacons are nature's reality, fundamental rights, moral authority, system overhaul, big vision. Well, the first and foremost must be nature's reality. We have to understand it, come to grips with it, and start making truly strategic decisions in response. When we operate in a political frame, we view outcomes as successful, just because they're hard-fought and consensus was finally reached after years of polarized conflict. But political wins have nothing to do with nature's requirements. A few habitat conservation plans with wide stream buffers are not enough for our biodiversity crisis. Whatever chips were on the table decades ago, they've vanished in the industry's onslaught over the last four decades. Nature's tattered systems are in collapse, and there's really nothing left to bargain away. And so solutions must come from finding new economic models, pairing environmental goals with social goals, and creating new types of jobs. The old ways of negotiating have run into a dead end.
You're listening to Mary Wood on environmental law and the defense of nature. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
As part of nature's reality, here's the hard part. We need to understand carbon math. Scientists have determined that the highest safe zone for atmospheric carbon is below 350 parts per million. And yet, here we sit with carbon dioxide levels rising over 419 parts per million. We have clearly entered a perilous danger zone. Our destiny is now governed by climate tipping points. If we spew too much more greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, the resulting temperature increase will trigger nature's own feedback loops, and those will unleash runaway heating that we can't call back. So that is why scientists constantly warn of a threshold of no return. For example, as just one example, we've already heated the planet so that the Arctic permafrost is beginning to melt. You can see the melt in that slide. And it contains vast amounts of carbon dioxide and methane. If that melt really gets going and unlocks all those greenhouse gases, well, that's the threshold of no return. Scientists stress that greenhouse gas emissions must drop 45% by 2030, and the world must fully decarbonize by 2050. We need to keep a laser focus, because 2030 is just 7 years from now. And this 45% is not some arbitrary figure. It's an emergency brake to prevent us from going over climate tipping points and the climate cliff. I'm always shocked when reporters speak of these numbers as climate goals. They sound no more binding than a runner's 5-minute mile goal. They certainly don't evoke any sense that humanity's survival depends on us attaining these carbon cuts. But at least finally, we have a president who speaks of these imperatives. Just 6 years ago, we had President Obama with all of the above energy policy completely disconnected from any carbon math. And just 4 years ago, Trump's insane pledge to develop $50 trillion worth of fossil fuels in this country hung over us like an indescribable pall. The fact of carbon math is we can't have fossil fuels and decarbonize too. We must keep this reality at the forefront of our minds. Either we continue to prop up the fossil fuel industry and doom humanity, or we force rapid wind down of this dangerous industry and preserve a chance. We can't have it both ways, and we can't hand this choice over to Exxon or BP or Shell by default. The choice is ours. It falls on us as the people who just happen to be alive at this moment.